It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. We visit a town this morning that is working to transition away from a coal-dominated economy.
When you have mountain bikers come to your town, they're going to come out of the woods and come down and frequent your restaurants.
We'll have that coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. The Appalachian Queer Film Festival is back in West Virginia after taking a hiatus. Emily Allen reports people in the Charleston area spent the weekend watching LGBTQ-themed cinema at the Flora Lee Hart Cohen Theater.
It's Friday night, and we're in a small, intimate theater underneath the Taylor Books coffee shop in downtown Charleston. That music you hear is the opening credits to a feature-length film called To the Stars. It's about a withdrawn teenager, Iris, in rural Oklahoma, who befriends a new girl in her class from the city. Here's the opening scene. Iris's mom is making her daughter a prom dress.
You are going to that prom? I'll have to sell my body to get you a date.
This film kicked off the 2019 Appalachian Queer Film Festival, an event celebrating queer-related cinema with rural or Appalachian ties. Here's John Matthews, co-founder and co-curator for the festival.
You know, we try to have, you know, films that kind of make you think and see things in a different light.
Matthews is a filmmaker currently living in Los Angeles, but he grew up in West Virginia. When he agreed to start a film festival in his home state with friend Tim Ward, an Appalachian, now in New York, Matthew says the title alone was the selling point.
He's like, it's the Appalachian Queer Film Festival. I'm like, done. You've got me. Sold. That was the pitch right there. That was all I needed to hear.
Ward and Matthews managed to secure a grant from the West Virginia Humanities Council. The festival they put together later that year eventually made its way into several national magazines, including Vice, IndieWire, and the Huffington Post. A couple years later, Matthew says the Appalachian Queer Film Festival was noticed by a different organization.
Well, in 2016, the Koch brothers, the notorious Koch brothers, did a study on government waste in West Virginia.
The Koch brothers-funded study, Wild and Wasteful West Virginia, said the festival was using state dollars to show films that, quote, many taxpayers would find objectionable. Whether it was related or not, the West Virginia Humanities Council ultimately decided against renewing the festival's grant.
You know, a small festival like that, you know, it's kind of really hurts.
This weekend was the festival's first time back since taking a hiatus. For Matthews, the Appalachian Queer Film Festival is about more than bringing queer films to West Virginia. It's about showing the rest of the world parts of West Virginia that often don't make the big screen.
We want to bring good film here, but also like to bring people from out of state here and show them like, hey, like we don't meet all the stereotypes that you might have in your head. Like we're much more open-minded and we love good cinema.
Matthew says he's confident the group will have another festival next year. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Allen.
In 2018, Sarah Smarsh released her New York Times best-selling memoir, The Heartland, exploring her childhood growing up on a farm in central Kansas. It was a National Book Award finalist and thrust her into the spotlight for writing about life in rural America from rural America. Now Smarsh is expanding her focus on life in rural Kansas to regions across the country, inviting Appalachian filmmakers, Black Belt farmers, and farm workers from California's Central Valley, among others, to discuss what she sees as a shift in America's, the trend of young people moving from their elite urban cities back home. It's the focus of the new podcast, The Homecomers, which she discussed with 100 Days in Appalachia's Ashton Mara.
So at the end of each episode, you thank Wes Jackson of the Land Institute for borrowing the term that he coined, homecomers, which, you know, is the title of your podcast. Can you tell us what that phrase means and why you connected with it so personally?
The sort of driving theme of this show, while, you know, it is about rural America, yeah, that's a vast concept, contrary to some national headlines that would reduce it to to one thing or another. What I'm specifically talking about is what I perceive by way of some data, yes, but also just my sense as someone on the ground, as a journalist and someone who travels all over the country talking to folks, of a real shift in the zeitgeist, this American tale that we've had for a long time of the small town or the rural kid who is encouraged to or on his or her own volition leaves home for the commercial mecca, the urban coastal shiny thing, that there seems to be a shift in the other direction. And some of the numbers are starting to bear this out. And I certainly in a very qualitative way have heard conversation after conversation with people who say to me, hey, I read your book about how you are, you're from this place where we're encouraged to, quote unquote, get out. And yet you're still riding. You're still in Kansas and you're writing from that place about the good, bad and the ugly. And these folks say to me, that's me. So this is a shift in the American story as relates to place and class that's just been kind of underreported and underexplored.
This kind of push of young people, of young generations out of the rural places that they're from to bigger cities to find success, you know, that it feels like a very Appalachian narrative to me. Did you personally feel like you had to leave your home in Kansas in order to succeed?
In some ways I did. You know, so I grew up on a wheat and cattle farm about 30 miles west of Wichita. Growing up, you know, I was an ambitious, bright kid. And I understood, you know, there are folks who come from rural and small town places who are just like, this is not my jam. I got to get to the city. And the second I get there, I'm going to be a city person and I'm going to do that the rest of my life. The getting out for me was that I wanted to get out of a certain sort of circumstance. I wanted to get out of poverty. I wanted to get out of lack of economic and professional opportunity. I didn't want to get out of my place, though. I love Kansas. I love rural Kansas. I love my family. I love my community. And those two goals, unfortunately, were somewhat opposed to one another. So I did, you know, I was a first generation college student at the University of Kansas. And then I did go on after a brief reporting stint in Kansas City to live in New York City for a couple of years. People thought I had lost my mind when I left New York in my mid-20s to move back to Kansas. And yet it felt right for various reasons. I did it. And I'm not going to say that it was, you know, the universe suddenly rewarded me for my, you know, for being true to myself. You know, it was a very hard road to hoe as a journalist in Kansas at that moment. So the story of an American homecoming, if you will, the conversations that I host in the homecomers are, you know, all over this enormous nation. And what they all have in common is the idea of home and that sense of responsibility and love and place being somehow at odds with the way our current economic and class structure works. And so the people who are going back or who are saying, I'm not going to leave, they are heroes in sort of rectifying what has become a severe social imbalance between rural and urban America.
So then do you feel like you're seeing a shift in this narrative around home? I think, you know, I see so many people in my life personally who have moved away and are starting to think about coming back to West Virginia, you know, just because their families are still here. They're getting married. They want to start families of their own. Mm-hmm. And I see them grapple with this idea of failure. If I come back, I have failed. You know, as you have these conversations with people, do you see them push away and push back at that idea of if I go home, I have failed?
Gosh, that is such a good question. And it really gets to the heart of the American psyche, to my mind, in that our sort of foundational tale of ourselves is about individualism. It's about and the ambitious seeker striking out and making good and doing better than her parents. And it's all quite aspirational. And the story that we have tracked along that aspiration has to do with an exodus from places that are a classist society views as backward, undesirable. Why would anybody want to live there? You know, the term that we that some sociologists coined to refer to people seeking college educations kind of being siphoned away from particular areas of this country is brain drain, and that there is a sort of condescension inherent that the people who stay behind must be dumb. And of course, that's not the case at all. Some of the most brilliant people I know are people who never left. So we've got to get more sophisticated as a country in how we appraise the relationship between one's location and one's merit.
That was author and journalist Sarah Smarsh speaking with Ashton Mara of 100 Days in Appalachia. To listen to an extended version of the interview and read more, visit 100daysinappalachia.com. As the Coal Valley's coal industry continues to decline, many coal-dependent communities are left asking, what's next? For some, a different kind of natural resource could be the key. Reporter Brittany Patterson visited one community in Southwest Virginia that's betting big on outdoor recreation and getting some help from an unusual local resident.
Just a few miles from the brick building lined streets of downtown Norton lies a city-owned 1,000-acre outdoor recreation paradise.
So we are now entering the Flag Rock Recreation Area.
Fred Ramey is Norton City Manager. Inside the park, there are signs that read, Trail Crossing, Official Wood Booger Sanctuary.
All right, what's up with the wood booger?
You want the real story? Now, the wood booger came about actually unexpectedly.
A local legend about a Bigfoot-style creature got national exposure.
On this episode of Finding Bigfoot, the team from the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization heads to Southwest Virginia to investigate a Bigfoot sighting.
After this Animal Planet show aired in 2012, new visitors came to Norton searching for the legendary animal locals now call the wood booger.
It's been good for business.
Steve Jesse works at Home Hardware and Furniture in downtown Norton, which sells t-shirts with the wood booger's likeness. The city created the Wood Booger Sanctuary, and it even spawned a festival in October that draws hundreds of people.
People just have a lot of fun with it.
Ramey says the town has something a lot more solid than a mythical mountain creature. Norton is betting on the very real value of the mountains around them. For decades, coal was king here, but since 2008, Virginia's coal production has fallen by about half.
In a certain way, our community has found itself at another intersection. And due to the loss of coal, and that's when we had to really start thinking differently.
The city already has a service-based economy. Things like hotels, restaurants, good roads are already here. So tourism made a lot of sense.
It just made common sense to us that we ought to look at expanding our potential in tourism.
But becoming a tourist mecca doesn't happen overnight. The city has invested in 8 miles of mountain bike trails, with more going in every day.
When you have mountain bikers come to your town, they're going to come out of the woods and come down and frequent your restaurants.
Shane Fields is the trail coordinator for Norton and an avid cyclist.
You'll have patronage at your restaurants, your hotels, any little shops you have in town.
Mark Haggerty with the nonprofit research group Headwaters Economics says several communities have had success making this transition from coal to outdoor recreation. But he warns outdoor recreation by itself is no silver bullet.
Recreation is really a means to an end. So what a recreation strategy does for you is it makes your community more attractive, and it has to be set within a broader economic development strategy.
Walking the trails in Flag Rock Recreation Area, Fred Ramey says he agrees.
We're not saying that tourism is going to be our answer, but we believe it can be part of the solution.
While numbers are hard to come by, Ramey says judging by license plates from Florida and North Carolina in the parking lot on this random weekday, it does seem to be working. And if one of them finds the wood booger, all the better.
We've got a friend that believes in Bigfoots and stuff.
All right. We're going through with you.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson in Norton, Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.